The third case for oral argument this morning is Pete Lean and Sons Appellant versus Bruce Lean, Indiana Lean. Appellees for the appellant, we have Mr. Larry Von Wald, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellees, Mr. Mitchell Peterson, attorney from Sioux Falls. As you can see, this is not our normal panel. We have a few disqualifications this morning. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, the presiding judge of the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Justice Konenkamp has disqualified himself. The court has appointed the Honorable Stuart Keady, circuit judge of the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. And Justice Zinner has disqualified himself. And the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, retired justice of this court, to sit in his place. Mr. Von Wald, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. I appear on behalf of the appellant, Pete Lean & Sons, Inc. The case now before the court raises the issue of whether the term price as used in the context of a right of first refusal includes, in addition to cash, other consideration-related terms that are offered by a third party proposing to purchase corporate stock. The facts of this case began to develop during early 2006. On January 31 of 2006, Deanna Lean, on behalf of her husband Bruce H. Lean, and her and individually, and as his conservator and guardian, entered into a stock purchase agreement with Old Castle Materials, Inc. The stock purchase agreement provided for the sale of all of the capital stock of Pete Lean & Sons, Inc. that was owned by Bruce Lean and Deanna Lean, and provided for a cash price of $35,250,000. In addition to the cash price, provided for the control of the company claims that Bruce Lean and Deanna Lean had against the company to be conveyed to the buyer, at that particular point, Old Castle Materials. On the following day, on February 1 of 2006, Deanna Lean caused to be delivered by hand a notice of intent to sell. The notice of intent to sell was conveyed to the board of directors of Pete Lean & Sons pursuant to Article 6 of the amended Articles of Incorporation of the company. Article 6 of the corporation provided that the stock in the company was subscribed and issued upon the condition that would not be sold to any other party other than existing shareholder without notice first being given, offering that stock to the corporation or the shareholders pro rata at the price for which a bona fide offer had been obtained. In addition, that right of first refusal provided that if the board of directors and the shareholders would decline to purchase that stock, that then the person providing notice, the shareholder who was proposing to sell his or her stock, would then be free, to sell that stock upon the terms set forth in the offer to the corporation. So the right of first refusal used both the word price and the word term in that regard. It's important.
So does this come down to a matter of law that we have to interpret these words, or is it dependent partly on the facts of the case?
Your Honor, it certainly does depend upon the facts, but the facts are undisputed that are material to this issue, and it is a question of law. You're absolutely correct, Justice Meyer Henry. In this particular instance, it's important to note that when the notice of intent to sell was delivered to the corporation, it stated that the purchase price of the stock was $35,250,000, quote, subject to the terms and conditions of the stock purchase agreement, unquote. It's expressly made that offer subject to those terms and conditions. Then on February 6 of 2006, 5 days after the notice of intent to sell was conveyed to the company sent a written notice to Deanna Lean, providing her with a notice that it intended to exercise its right of first refusal pursuant to the Articles of Incorporation. And again, that exercise of notice stated that it was being done pursuant to the terms of the stock purchase agreement that had been entered into on January 31 between Old Castle Materials and Deanna Lean.
So if that hadn't included that provision of not suing them, though the other commitments would have been enforceable. Is that what your argument is?
Well, the argument is, Your Honor, that Pete Lean & Sons, in addition to being entitled to receive the stock from the liens, was also entitled to the other terms that have been offered by Oldcastle, namely, what you're referring to, of course, is Section 4.5 of the stock purchase agreement, where Deanna Lean covenanted that she and Bruce Lean would not pursue any claim against the company.
Had that not been in there, then we wouldn't be here, and they could actually enforce both provisions.
That is exactly right. Were those provisions not there, and were Pete Lean & Sons not entitled to the benefit of those provisions, we would not be before the court. 4.5, as you have alluded to, is that in addition to stating that the sellers would not pursue any claim against the company or commence any proceeding without the consent of the company, also provided that the sellers, upon request, would assign their company claims to the buyer. The last provision of that section stated that they would cooperate in connection with those company claims. In this particular case, Pete Lean & Sons requested that those claims be denied. The sellers have declined to do so.
Well, if we follow your rationale then, Bruce and Deanna knew that once they completed the deal with Oldcastle, they were probably not going to be able to remain in their home.
Yes, that would be true, Your Honor, is when they had completed the stock purchase agreement based upon the terms that they had negotiated with Oldcastle Materials, an agreement that they together had negotiated and written, they knew that they were separating themselves from the company and that there would no longer be any connection with the company or any claims to be made. And the stock purchase agreement of the $35,250,000 would be reduced by the company claims that are at issue here today. When that offer was made to Pete Lean & Sons, it became an option that Pete Lean & Sons elected to exercise, and it became a binding contract. In this particular case, it has been asserted on behalf of Deanna Lean that Pete Lean & Sons is not entitled to those terms, that this was they referred to as a price ROFR or a price right of first refusal. That position, Your Honor, I would submit, is totally inconsistent with all of the law that exists on that subject. All of the law that we have submitted to you in the briefs, none other cases have been cited on behalf of Deanna Lean, other than the three principal cases dealing with the subject. The first one is the Union Oil Company of California versus Mobile Oil Pipeline Company case, a case that was decided by the Court of Chancery of Delaware in December 2006. And I might add parenthetically that decision was filed after the trial court's decision in this case. Earlier cases, however, also held that price includes all consideration-related terms. Most notably, the case out of the Texas Court of Appeals in McMillan versus Dooley, a case decided in calendar year 2004. That case involved the facts were somewhat complex in terms of the business dealings. It involved farm-out agreements that are customarily made in the oil and gas business, and those farm-out agreements contained right of first refusal provisions. That case was cited in the Union Oil Company or the Unical case.
So price, you're saying, takes on a broader term than maybe just the plain and normal understanding of the word price.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that it would be a a usual and commonly understood meaning of the word price to mean more than cash consideration. In other words, if there are terms accompanying it. As an example of that would be the case of Abraham Investment Company, a 1998 case, Abraham Investment Company versus Payne Ranch, another Texas Court of Appeals case where the party holding the right of first refusal made what amounted to a counteroffer, offered to buy a ranch, but insisted upon paying part of the cash over an extended period of time and for a higher rate of interest than had been proposed by the third-party offeror. In that particular case, the court pointed out that price means more than cash. It includes those terms. There's been some. There might be some confusion if one were to read the case of West Texas Gas Transmission LP versus Enron. That's a 1990 case out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And in that particular case, and this has been suggested on behalf of Deanna Lean, that somehow stands for the proposition that we're to distinguish between price ROFRs and terms and conditions ROFRs. If one looks at that case carefully, you will conclude otherwise. As the Vice Chancellor wrote in the opinion of Union Oil Company, those writings in the West Texas Gas Transmission case are dicta. The cases cited there, none of them support the proposition that a right of first refusal is, the terms of the right of first refusal should be restricted to cash consideration. Absolutely not. So, in this particular case...
Do any of those include a provision or involve a provision with an agreement not to pursue a claim against the buyer?
None of those cases dealt directly with that, Your Honor.
Is there significance that we're talking here about a claim?
I think not, Your Honor. In those particular cases, the rights of first refusal were remarkably close in terms of the way they were written to the right of first refusal that we have now before the court. Except the one that we have now before the court, the one that appears in Article 6 of the Pete Lean and Sons amended Articles of Incorporation, even makes it more clear. Example, in the Unocal case, only the word price was used. And Unocal asserted that, said, well, you've only used the word price, that must mean that you can't take advantage of any other terms and conditions. And the court said no. Such an extreme interpretation is not warranted by not using or incorporating the word term. In our ROFR that we have before the court, both the word price and the word term is used. They are used interchangeably. When one reads that, it's unmistakable that they are used interchangeably, and the word price is used in the ordinary and commonly understood meaning. I think it was in the McMillan versus Dooley case that the court cited to Black's Law Dictionary, and where it's held that price means all material consideration that's exchanged for the property being acquired.
Well, the Unocal case is unreported, right?
It is, Your Honor.
Can it be cited?
I believe it can under the rules of the court, Your Honor.
The thing that troubles me is the language in Article 6. I mean, when you consider the rules of construction, if they intended to say terms or terms and conditions, they knew how to say that, because in the latter part of the article they said that. But up above, where they were talking about the right of first refusal, they only used the word price. The Unocal case says, well, everybody knows that in a right of first refusal, you get all the terms and conditions. That's just the way sophisticated business people are, but there's very limited authority cited in that Unocal case to support that proposition. Why aren't we just supposed to look at the plain language and say, if you intended to sell or use terms and conditions, you should have said it?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that you can look at the terms of Article 6, and you wouldn't need the assistance of the Unocal case. And the reason for that is when you read the last paragraph of Article 6, the part of the ROFR that refers to terms and conditions, it states that if the company or the shareholders elect to refuse you know, do not exercise their right of first refusal, then the seller can make it available to the offering party on the terms and conditions in his notice. And so that would be in the terms and conditions given in the notice to the corporation. And so that makes it very clear. It makes it very clear that the company and the board of directors and the stockholders pro rata are entitled to all those terms and conditions. So here we have a much simpler case than what we're talking about in Unical, or what we're talking about in McMillan versus Dooley, or Abraham Investments Company versus Payne Ranch. We do have that benefit. In those other cases, they didn't have the benefit of the word term in their ROFR. They had price, and they said, in spite of that, price causes the holder of the right to enjoy all of the consideration that's being proposed by the third party. In this particular case, we have a position that's been taken on behalf of Deanna Lean that's inconsistent with her notice to sell. Her notice to sell said it's subject to the terms and conditions of this agreement. And now they want to back away from that. That's inconsistent with that. Secondly, it's inconsistent with the ROFR itself. A contract existed, and Pete Lane & Sons asked that the contract be enforceable. In this particular case, it's been asserted that the word claim means something other than a right that exists. Again, if one looks at dictionary terms, whether it's Black's Law Dictionary or a dictionary such as Webster-Merriam's Collegiate Dictionary, the word claim means an existing right. It doesn't require that there be a cause of action that exists. The agreement provides in 9.3 that is to be governed by the laws of the state of New York. It's to be construed and enforced according to the laws of the state of New York. This court has said in the Green case that when a parties agree to be bound by the laws of another jurisdiction, that the contracts that they make will be construed in accordance with those laws. Under the laws of the state of New York, these claims were freely assignable. There have been cases cited for the court where the courts of New York have allowed claims for compensation, even though that compensation hasn't come due or is a right arising in the future to be assigned. Your Honor,
well, they could have given consent, right? Am I reading that right? I mean, the claims, they can't pursue their claims unless there's a prior written consent. Am I reading the right
that's
provision?
That's correct.
What you're saying is this whole thing is still in effect, but if your clients would give a written consent, they could still go after these claims.
Well,
is that right?
No. Under the facts of this particular case, Pete Lane & Sons has requested that those company claims be assigned to it, and that request has not been honored. It refused to do that. And so under the terms of the stock purchase agreement, essentially, Pete Lane & Sons has been denied the same terms and conditions that were made available to Oldcastle Materials when it entered into the agreement. And that's the essence of the claim.
So where did the trial court go wrong?
The trial court held, Your Honor, very simply, that the word price does not include anything else other than cash consideration, made a very narrow construction of that word. Just like the proponents on behalf of Unical and the Union Oil Company case did, which was rejected by the Court of Chancery and which has been rejected by the Texas Court of Appeals in McMillan versus Dooley, and also in the case of Abraham Investment Company versus Payne Ranch. Price has a broader meaning. It's not limited simply to cash consideration. And that's the essence of the case, is that holding once one recognizes that price has a much broader term, then it compels the conclusion that Pete Lean & Sons was entitled to all of the terms and conditions set forth in the January 31 stock purchase agreement entered into between Oldcastle Materials and Deanna Lean. For those reasons, Your Honor, we would respectfully submit that the summary judgment entered in favor of the appellee, Deanna Lean, should be reversed, and summary judgment and judgment entered in favor of Pete Lean & Sons. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Just remain at the podium for a minute, please. Mr. Peterson, would you approach the podium, too, please? It has come to our attention that during this proceeding, and I'm not sure whether it was the circuit court or on an appellate proceeding, that Bruce Lean passed away. And so I assume that both sides want a decision on the merits on this case. So I would request that parties prepare a stipulation pursuant to 15625A1, which invokes that archaic language suggestion of death, so that we have a proper substitution of the parties. And there's no question on this court's jurisdiction. Did either one of you have a problem with that?
Not at all.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I didn't want to address that until you got up because he's your client. So, all right. Thank you, Mr. Grunwald. Very well, then. Mr. Peterson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. The articles of incorporation in this case provide a limited price-only right of first refusal. What Pete Lean & Sons seeks to do is have this court rewrite that agreement and erase the word price from the right of first refusal. This case is a bit unique and it involves a right of first refusal that really doesn't appear in any of the case law that's been located by the parties in this case. That right of first refusal provides that Pete Lean and, or the liens must allow Pete Lean & Sons to purchase the stock at said price. And if that exercise is not made, then the holder may sell the same on the terms specified in the notice. The right of first refusal also specifically provides that upon Pete Lean & Sons tendering the purchase price, the liens will assign or transfer their stock to the company or the shareholder, if it's a shareholder that makes that election. That makes this right of first refusal fairly unique and certainly is distinguishable from the unreported case of Unical that internally has very thin support. Under the law of South Dakota, the McCrodden case, the articles of incorporation or the document granting the right of first refusal control the right of first refusal. Additionally, typically contracts are construed under the plain and ordinary meaning of the words, but in the context of a right of first refusal, it must be strictly construed in favor of the free transfer of stock or property. That is because public policy disfavors alienation, the ability of a party to alienate property. With that in mind, when you turn to the right of first refusal that says the company can pay the same price, they can match the price, they can tender the purchase price, and if they don't, we get the same terms and conditions that's put in the notice. There's really only one plain and ordinary way to read that. It doesn't use those terms interchangeably. The articles use price and terms in distinct ways, very distinct ways. In this case, obviously, Pete Lean & Sons wants the benefit of the terms, but there could certainly be a conceivable deal where Pete Lean & Sons would not want to do anything other than match price. There's certainly a deal that could be made where that would work to their benefit.
Just on a side, kind of a side issue from your where you're going here, had they not exercised their option, would those claims have been precluded had the other buyer purchased it?
No, Your Honor. And the reason why is the actual language of the Oldcastle agreement. And if you get to the point where Pete Lean & Sons steps into the shoes, or if you look at this from the perspective of what if Oldcastle would have bought the stock, Section 2.19 of the agreement lists the various contractual obligations, which in this case would be a severance agreement, the lease and option agreement and the shareholder notes that are at issue. Section 2.4 then goes on to say that nothing in the Oldcastle agreement will cause a breach of or conflict with any contractual obligation. Section 2.15 specifically says that the contractual obligations set forth in the agreement are valid and binding. And then on top of that, you have Section 9.11 of the release that specifically says that all obligations are discharged with the exception of obligations set forth in this agreement. And at the last sentence of the release, it states that all claims are released from the beginning of time up to, through, and including the date of signing this agreement. So the question is, if Bruce and Deanna Lean truly were giving up $500,000 under a severance agreement, writing off $300,000 in debt, and moving out of their home that they've lived in for 25 years, why doesn't the agreement say something different? Why doesn't it say the obligations are extinguished and you shall not make any claim, you shall not assert any right under a contract, you don't have rights under the severance agreement, and prepare to move out within 30 days of the closing? It doesn't say that. In fact, it recognizes those agreements as valid and binding, and stating that nothing in the agreement will conflict with those obligations and contractual arrangements. What Pete Lean and Sons hangs its hat on is Section 4.5, which is a covenant not to sue. It doesn't say that it applies to future unaccrued claims. There, at the time of the agreement, there were unaccrued claims. There was a future possibility of a bonus under the severance agreement. Certainly, there's ongoing obligations under the lease. There's $300,000 in debt that Pete Lean and Sons thinks they get a pass on based on the agreement that says nothing about that.
Well, Oldcastle is a pretty sophisticated entity, I suspect. Is it your argument that they were willing to buy a lawsuit to pay $35.25 million to Bruce and Deanna, with the risk that Bruce and Deanna down the road could renew another claim for oppression of shareholders or whatever else may be lurking out there or could have been lurking out there, that they were prepared to do that?
Your Honor, that's precisely the point of the release, releasing everything up to and including the time of the shareholder agreement, and that any claims would be assigned upon request. Those would be claims in the past, not unaccrued future claims. And that would be issues related to, you know, some argument that Bruce wasn't paid a dividend a year before the agreement. Oldcastle didn't want to buy into that. They knew what the obligations were on an ongoing basis with the severance agreement, with the shareholder notes, and with the lease. What they didn't want is the unknown, what's underneath the covers, what's behind the curtain. And that's everything in the past, and that's what was discharged under the agreement. And that's precisely what the agreement calls for. When you look at Section 9.11 with the release, it's clear it's past claims. And under Section 4.5, it certainly could have been written that it would apply to future unaccrued claims, but it wasn't written that way. It was just past claims, such as shareholder oppression. Additionally, under the Oldcastle agreement, for the first time, Pete Lean and Sons brings up the issue of application of New York law. Obviously, we do not have a chance to respond to that because it appeared in the reply brief. But even presuming that, I would respond in a few ways. Number one, that term is not consideration related and wouldn't be incorporated, so South Dakota law should apply. Number two, certainly the Green case on choice of law is controlling, but within that and also other precedent, this court routinely looks to the restatement of conflicts. And if you look to the restatement of conflicts, Section 187, choice of law provisions are not respected when there is no substantial relationship to the dispute or when the public policy of a state with a materially greater interest conflicts with the law that is to be applied. In this case, certainly there's a basis for New York law as between the Leans and Oldcastle, but as between Pete Lean and Sons and the Leans, they're all in South Dakota. It's South Dakota stock and a South Dakota company. There's no substantial relationship. And thirdly, even if the court would get to New York law, that I would encourage the court to look closely at the decision cited, the McMahon case. First of all, the terms of that covenant not to sue in the McMahon case aren't even set forth in the court opinion. It's a very brief page and a half decision. And it states that when there is an existing obligation, you construe language that's not quite a covenant not to or not to sue, not quite a release. If there's an existing obligation, it's construed to be a release. If there's no existing obligation between the parties, then it's a covenant not to sue. And in that case, because there were actually existing obligations between the parties, the court held that the agreement was a release and applying to past claims. On top of that, the Campbell case cited by Peatling and Sons simply holds that covenants not to sue for future unaccrued claims are enforceable. You just need to have a clear agreement. The liens have never asserted otherwise. And that's consistent with our case law as well. With when you look at pre-event releases, there's a softball and a racetrack case. I don't recall the name right offhand. But as long as the agreements are clear that you are giving up your right to unaccrued, unknown future claims, it can be enforceable, but it needs to say that specifically. In this case, Section 4.5 does not say that. Another thing to look at, too, back in the first issue of do we even get to the Old Castle Agreement? Is that included within the right of first refusal election? This was not lost on Judge Delaney, and certainly it's a de novo standard of review, but the analysis provided by Judge Delaney, I think, is right on the mark, that you've got a covenant not to sue and a release negotiated between a buyer and a seller. Now, when the company steps into the buyer position, it's now trying to take releases that were in the buyer-seller relationship and expand those into a shareholder-corporation relationship. That's not not within the scope or the intent of that agreement. And as Judge Delaney said, as the release of the PLS obligation was not part of the agreement in the first place, it cannot rise phoenix-like from the ashes from the displaced third-party buyer. And that's exactly what Peatling and Sons is trying to do here, is it has other relationships with the liens. And by stepping into the third-party buyer position, it's trying to expand the scope of that agreement beyond the contemplation of the parties.
If frequently in transactions like this, there's a covenant not to compete. Wasn't in this case, but if there had been, and if there had been allocated, say, $5 or $10 million of the purchase price for the covenant, under your rationale, since we have to look at the price for the stock, would it be your argument then that Pete Lean would only owe the $30 or $25 million for the stock and not have to assume the obligation on the covenant not to compete?
Based on the strict construction of the right of first refusal, I think that is true. If Peatling and Sons had wanted all terms and conditions, or literally to step into the shoes of the third-party buyer, they could have negotiated that. Now, there's going to be times when a third-party deal would be beneficial for them to step into the shoes, and there may be deals where it wouldn't be. And a decision was made to draft the right of first refusal as it was drafted. And this court should strictly construe that and not rewrite the terms that were selected. So in that case, with the covenant not to compete, I don't think that would apply, Your Honor, because of the actual language of the right of first refusal. This court has as many times said that it's not going to rewrite the contracts between parties, and particularly when you have a right of first refusal that's strictly construed, the court should do just that. It should construe it to mean that Peatling and Sons matches the price only. They tender the price, and they get the stock. That's the deal that was struck, and that's the deal that was received in this case. And they're trying to get more than that because it works to their advantage in this situation.
But don't we have to also consider the notice that was given by Ms. Lean, where she clearly said, subject to the terms and conditions, not just the price, not just the transfer of the stock for the price, but the terms and conditions of the entire agreement. And the acceptance from Pete Lean and Sons used the same language, and the deal was closed.
Well, I would have two responses, Your Honor. First of all, the actual notice, which is Appendix E to Appellant's brief, says, quote, this notice is given pursuant to Article 6 of the amended Articles of Incorporation of Pete Lean & Sons, Inc., end quote. That controls the right of first refusal. Whatever rights they have under the Articles of Incorporation are the only rights that Pete Lean & Sons has. Nothing in this notice can expand or reduce those rights. There's been no case law cited by Pete Lean & Sons that allows that.
Why didn't the notice just say then the purchase price for the shares is $35,250,000, period? Why the language subject to the terms and conditions set forth in the stock purchase agreement?
That is because of the particular nature in which the purchase price is drafted. There's actually a section, Section 1.2. It's on the first page of Appendix H. It defines the purchase price under the stock sale agreement. And there's a number of paragraphs. And in this case, the gross price was $35.25 million. But really, it was $30,250,000 because $5 million of that was contingent upon the financial performance of Pete Lean & Sons. And that's set forth as one of the terms of the purchase price.
But doesn't that undercut your argument? Why didn't you insist upon the $35,250,000 in cash? Why did you accept those additional terms and conditions under the escrow agreement?
Those are the purchase price specific terms as to when it's paid and how much is paid, and it's determined by an external factor being the performance of Pete Lean & Sons. That's the algorithm that determines exactly what the purchase price is. And Pete Lean & Sons needs to say, we'll agree to do that, or go ahead and sell to Oldcastle. And the purchase price terms are the terms that would be incorporated that says exactly how that purchase price is paid, but not everything else in this agreement.
But how does that distinguish from the allocation of the purchase price, some to a covenant not to compete, some to the stock, maybe a few dollars to something else? Isn't it all part of the purchase price?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the purchase price is, I think, clear under the right of first refusal because it talks about Pete Lean & Sons tendering the purchase price. I can't conceive how one tenders something other than purchase price or tangible property. When you look at that in connection with the actual drafting and description of the purchase price in the agreement, it's clear. I mean, if they wanted each and every possible term under the agreement, that could have been put in the articles, but it was not, and it needs to be strictly construed under the McCrodden case and the other cases cited in our brief. Briefly, I want to touch on issues related to the severance agreement. Other than the Oldcastle agreement extinguishing the severance agreement, the only argument raised is consideration. The severance agreement was not contingent. It did not say Bruce Lean had to remain a shareholder of the company. There were absolutely no conditions put on it. It was provided to Bruce Lean, and the benefits were accepted there under, which is a binding contract under 5377 of our codified laws. Consideration is and must be determined at the time a contract is made. Not at any other time, but because it's a fundamental threshold issue of contract formation. Pete Lean & Sons admits that at the time that agreement was made and extended to Bruce Lean, they had a duty to refrain from squeeze-out tactics, shareholder oppression. They were concerned that if they didn't show some return on investment to Bruce Lean, there would be litigation and assertion of rights as a shareholder. Pete Lean & Sons wanted to buy peace, and that's exactly what they did until they breached the agreement. That is sufficient consideration. Bruce Lean had a right to receive a return on his investment. He didn't protest his treatment, and he accepted the benefits thereunder and relied on them in making the deal with Oldcastle. That is sufficient consideration at the time the contract was formed. Finally, I want to touch briefly on an issue that was raised in a reply brief as to whether the severance agreement is an employee benefit plan regulated by ERISA. The new issue raised is that the benefits didn't vest and that they can be yanked at any time. There's an Iowa case cited by Pete Lean & Sons. There's U.S. Supreme Court authority and Eighth Circuit authority that plainly provides that if an agreement, and specifically a severance agreement, is reasonably capable of creating a promise, then that can't be changed and it can't be taken away. It's essentially vested. So I guess if the court goes that way, I just encourage the court to look at all the authority that's out there on that particular issue. To wrap up, Bruce and while he was alive, and Deanna lived in their home for 25 years. They've got a right to purchase that home. They loaned $300,000 to Pete Lean and Sons. There's another $500,000 due under a severance agreement. And there isn't anything in the Old Castle Agreement that specifically and expressly says those obligations are extinguished and that they can't enforce them. In the absence of something pretty specific, it should be this court's conclusion that it was never intended within the scope of the Old Castle Agreement that those rights would be extinguished. Adding to that is the right of strictly construing any exonerating provision of release, a covenant not to sue. They need to be very specific and express as to what precisely is being released and given up. There isn't any language that is that specific in this case. And in fact, quite the contrary. The Old Castle Agreement says the agreements are valid and binding. And this court should find that, number one, the right of first refusal allows only an assumption of the price. Number two, even if the Old Castle Agreement applies, it doesn't extinguish the obligations in this case. And number three, that Bruce Lean and Deanna Lean are entitled to the severance benefits. For those reasons, we would respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of Judge Delaney.
One quick question. The judgment amount, was that based solely on the severance agreement and did not factor in anything under the lease and option or the notes?
It was stipulated between the parties. We just did the calculation on the severance and as well as the shareholder interest. And there's going to be some ongoing issues, too, that have been worked out by the parties by stipulation.
Essentially the severance agreement.
I think there might be shareholder interest on that, too. I could stand corrected, Mr. Bonwald, if I'm incorrect.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Bonwald, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. The appellees in this case, Your Honors, would have this court create a new ROFR, a price ROFR, something that no other court in the country has been willing to do, save and except those rights of first refusal that are somewhat uncommon, but provide for the cash price in the right of first refusal. No other court has distinguished between price ROFRs and terms and conditions ROFRs, not one. And that is what the appellees would have this court do, something that no other court has done. Those cases that we recited, the Unical case and the Abraham Investment Company case, McMillan versus Dooley, are instructive on that particular point. And they've said that amongst sophisticated entities, people understand that price includes more than cash consideration. Now, the suggestion that acting Justice Tiede made is right on the mark. Covenants not to compete. In this particular instance, we didn't have this kind of a term in this agreement, but if Old Castle had demanded a covenant not to compete in addition to the stock, the appellees would assert that Pete Lean and Sons would have had to pay the same amount of cash but would not have been entitled to the covenant not to compete. In other words, that they were to get a deal that was materially different than that Old Castle had bargained for. That, of course, runs counter to the essence of a right of first refusal. The right of first refusal, as we all understand, is to provide the holder with the same deal that a third party makes a bona fide offer for.
Even with that, if you follow that through, though, these were prior contractual commitments, which are not addressed at all. So what about the argument that it's only to future claims as opposed to current contractual obligations?
That argument, Justice Meyer Henry, would be inconsistent with the language of Section 4.5 of the Stock Purchase Agreement. It refers to claims and proceedings against the company. And as we've discussed earlier, claims includes any existing right or it includes any future right. And so those were very clearly encompassed within the agreement that Oldcastle made. When Oldcastle made its deal, it agreed to pay the cash consideration, but it also saved for itself the right to take control of those claims with against the company. If Oldcastle found itself in the position where it became a 50% shareholder in the corporation, it would be in the position where it owned those company claims. It would have those, and so its purchase price would be something less than the $35,250,000 that it deposited in the escrow account in the Bank of New York. And in order for Pete Lean & Sons to have the benefit of its right of first refusal, recognition must be given that it is entitled to those rights. And I want to go back to the terms of the right of first refusal again. It is important, and I agree with counsel, the McCrodin case makes clear that the rights of first refusal emanate from the Articles of Incorporation. What I disagree with is what it said, that those rights had nothing to do with the notice and offer that Ms. Lean sent to the Board of Directors. That is incorrect. Unical, the Payne case, Dooley case, all point out that the terms of the deal are governed by not only the right of first refusal, but the notice of intent to sell. And at that point, that becomes an option that is exercisable by the holder of the right of first refusal. And that's what occurred in this case. That is exactly what Pete Lane and Sons did. Now, it's been asserted as a backup argument that there was a contract, and it's even been referred to in the briefs as there was a severance contract. Well, as a matter of fact, there was no severance contract. There was a severance package that arose, as counsel has stated, when it was determined that Mr. Lean could no longer serve as an employee of the company. And based upon the prior history in this case, particularly the matter of Lean versus Lean that was decided by this court in January of 2004, the Board of Directors was particularly sensitive to making certain the compensation that Mr. Lean derived by virtue of his ownership of 50% of the stock in the corporation was not terminated, so that there would not be any allegation of freeze-out or squeeze-out. It was unilateral in nature. The Board of Directors, upon terminating his employment, stated that the corporate salary, bonuses, and perquisites would be continued just as they had been in the past. There would be no change. It would be simply denominated as a severance package to fulfill those fiduciary duties that it recognized existed to Mr. Lean. As this court pointed out in the case of Garrett versus Bank West, such a pre-existing duty cannot form the consideration for a new contract. And so the suggestion that there was a contract made when the board met and changed the salary and bonuses and corporate perquisites to a severance package is erroneous. Your Honor, for all of these reasons, it's respectively urged on behalf of Pete Lane & Sons, Inc. that the order granting summary judgment in favor of Deanna Lean and the judgment entered in her favor be reversed and that judgment be entered for Pete Lane & Sons. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gronwald. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.